Hello there, this is Bane. When I'm not out on the streets of Gotham hunting the Batman, I find myself listening to Part-Time Fanboy on a regular basis. Be sure to check out Part-Time Fanboy at www.parttimefanboy.com for somewhat weekly podcasts and reviews about various fanboy-related subjects. Also be sure to like them on Facebook and follow them on the Twitter. Do it now, or I'll have to do something awful to your spine.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Thank you so much for, you know, coming on to my podcast. I really do appreciate your time, particularly on a weekend. I know that you're a busy man, so you know, thank you for just lining up with me on a time to do a little chat. I really appreciate it.
Well, sure. I'm glad we were able to work that out, and something that works for your schedule as well as mine. So,
for those people listening, I should do introductions. This is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. And my name is Christian Horn, and I have a very special guest on the line. It's actually somebody that I've been wanting to interview for a while. I have John Morrow, correct? That is the correct name, right?
Correct, yes.
Any middle name?
Not that I want to give out.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. No full names on the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. So we have John Morrow on the line, who is the publisher of Tomorrow's publication. Publisher and owner, right? Just all around, you own the whole kit and caboodle, correct? Is that right?
Correct. Actually, I'm partners with my wife, Pam.
Gotcha.
Pamela. I am one Morrow. She is the other Morrow. So that's where we got two Morrows from.
Yeah, I love the title. I love the name of the publishing company.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we've been doing this since, our first Tomorrow's publication was our wedding invitation from 1986 that we designed. We met in design school, and when we decided to get married, we decided we're going to do non-conventional wedding invitation. So we designed a really interesting one, and that was the first time on the back of it says, a product of Tomorrow's design. Uh-huh. Was the name at the time. So, and from there, when we started the publishing thing, the name just kind of stuck.
Yeah. And Tomorrow's publishing, it is something that, the reason that we kind of started this interview or that we connected is because I got an email regarding your book called Stuff Said,
yes.
Which is one of your new books currently out that I do want to chat about. But like in a larger scope, can you describe to the listener, people that might not know, what Tomorrow's Publications is? Because it's one of my favorite. I used to collect Draw Magazine. You're having a special on there right now, which I may take advantage of, like a big bundle, because I fell off of Draw Magazine. But I've got like the Comic Book Chronicles, some of those encyclopedias, the Lou Scheimer book is something that I've loved from you guys. You guys just do like amazing, like God's work, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to comic fans, particularly like the history of comics. So can you just describe in a little less frantic mode that I just did what Tomorrow's is about?
Sure, Christian. I appreciate those kind words. We love when our fans go into frantic mode over our publications.
Yeah.
That makes us very happy. So. Well, we started in 1994. My wife and I had our advertising graphic design firm that we started right out of college. And after doing that for several years, self-employed that way, I had a little bit of free time. And Jack Kirby, the famous co-creator of the Marvel Universe with Stan Lee, had passed away in early 1994.
Yeah.
I'd kind of been out of comic books at that point. So after Watchmen and The Dark Knight and all that came out around 1988 or so, I kind of stepped away from comics at that point. I kind of felt like, okay, comics has gone about as far as it's going to go for me.
Uh-huh.
And so I sold off most of my collection, but I just kept, I kept my most treasured Jack Kirby books mainly, and a couple of Neil Adams things and things like that.
Sure.
But everything else kind of went to help us fund the down payment on our first house. So,
nice.
And, you know, it was kind of, I was done with comics, but I still held on to that dream of one day getting to meet Jack Kirby, which that had been a goal of mine ever since I was a little kid. And even though I'd been out of comics, I'd never been to the San Diego Comic-Con either. And finally, in 1991, a business trip kind of coincided just perfectly. So I would be out at San Diego when Comic-Con was going on. And so I was able to sneak away for just one afternoon for the convention and got to meet Jack Kirby for a few minutes and talk to him. And that was like, wow, I'm gone full circle with comics now. I'm done. Everything's great. I'm happy. And I thought that was all that would ever happen. But then when Jack Kirby passed away in 1994, I didn't even know about it the day it happened. A friend of mine faxed me a newspaper clipping from USA Today because he knew what a big Kirby fan I'd always been. And I was like, wow, that really hit me. And at that point, I pulled out the few, you know, Jack Kirby comics I still had. And I just reread them all through that spring. And that summer, I had a little free time. And I was like, well, you know, I've got all this graphic design software and a modicum of graphic design skills. Why don't I do a little newsletter for Jack Kirby fans? Surely he's still got a few fans out there.
Sure.
And so well, I had no idea, but you know, at that point, Kirby's career, he'd been out of comics for a while, and it was Image Comics was the big thing then, which was about as, you know, kind of far removed from the classic Kirby stuff as you can get. But I mocked up a sample issue and I sent it to Mr. Kirby's wife and to get her okay on it, because I didn't want to do anything that would, you know, the family wouldn't approve of. And she wholeheartedly supported it, which it's kind of funny because she didn't know me from Adam. And, you know, I could have been some weirdo stalker type comic fan or something like that. I mean, you know, she had no way to know. Yeah. But I guess she saw something kind of, you know, genuine and appealing there in that mock-up that I sent her, and she was all for it. So I printed up 125 copies of the Jack Kirby Collector number one. It was this nice little 16-page hand Xeroxed newsletter that I did. But it wasn't a rinky-dink looking, you know, like the typical old fanzines that were done on Mimeo graph machine 60s. This was, you know, it was done with professional design software and fonts and a sense of graphic design. And I think it kind of, it kind of just struck a chord with people. I just photocopied up 125 copies of this and sent them out for free to people that had written in letters when Jack Kirby died to Comics Buyer's Guide.
Oh, wow.
And I waited to just see what would happen. And, boy, was I shocked when I saw what happened. letter after letter after letter came in, and people started sending me copies of Kirby art from their collections and started wanting to write articles for it. And it just kind of out of nowhere just ballooned up into, you know, I honestly, when I told my wife, Pam, I wanted to do this thing, I asked what she thought of it. She said, sure, that'll be a fun little side hobby for you. Sure, go ahead and do it, right?
Yeah.
And she had no idea either where it would take both of us in our lives. But it's been quite a journey since then. It went from 125 free copies up to thousands when we started going through comic book shops. This new book, Stuff Said, is actually issue number 75 of the Jack Kirby Collector. So this is our 25 years doing this. This is our 25th anniversary, and we're up to issue 75 on the Kirby Collector. That's kind of the start of tomorrow's. Their Kirby Collector took off, and we're like, well, let's do a Jack Kirby Collector for all the other artists. And we came out with Comic Book Artist Magazine, which went on. John B. Cook edited that. He was my sort of assistant editor on the Jack Kirby Collector. Uh-huh. And he took that one and went on to win numerous Eisner Awards for CBA. From there, we started doing books, then other magazines like Draw, which you mentioned. Our current output, in addition to still doing the Kirby Collector, we're doing Back Issue Magazine, Alter Ego, which we work with Roy Thomas, the former editor-in-chief at Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And longtime comics fan. We still do Draw. We do our newest magazine is called Retro Fan, which Michael Urie, the editor of Back Issue, also edits Retro Fan. And it's geared more toward retro pop culture of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the stuff we all grew up with. Yeah. Also, we have a magazine for Lego enthusiasts called Brick Journal.
But yeah, I saw that.
It's a whole other story and a whole different audience. So, it's just been a crazy fun ride. And, 25 years here. No, I have no complaints. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I find it fascinating that, because that's part of the story I did not know, that you had sort of like walked away from comics and just been like, yeah, I'm kind of done with these for now. And I mean, you sort of hear that story, those stories from like fans who, I know that for me, I gave up comics for like a year once, and it was because of my first San Diego Comic-Con visit and breaking up with a girlfriend at the time, all at the same time. And I was like, I'm done with comics, but I can only last a year, like right. about a year. But I just find it fascinating. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was about comics at the time that sort of made you walk away? And then I just find it amazing that like, a guy who was like, yeah, I'm kind of done with this, is now so like just involved in it now, like 25 years later. Like that's just like a major life shift. Can you talk a little bit about both those?
Well, sure. And I think the key there is life shift. Yeah. For our Lego magazine, Brick Journal, the Lego builders, that's geared toward adult builders. And they have this, that's something they call their dark age. And if I can veer to Lego for a second,
sure.
Generally kids play with Lego bricks until they're 13, 14. And then they go through what the builders consider their dark age. It's usually from about age 15 to like 25, 26, 27. Mm-hmm. The male builders discover girls. They discover cars. you get older and you go to college, you know, you don't have the
sure.
funds for instance, or,
yeah,
and
yeah.
then you get married, start a family, that kind of thing. But then they get back into it 10 times more forcefully when they're adults after they come out of that dark age. I guess that's sort of what happened to me with comics. In 88, when Frank Miller's Dark Knight came out and Watchmen, I mean, I was blown away by those books and I loved them. I still love them today.
Yeah.
But it really did kind of feel like a natural sort of jumping off point for me because it was like, wow, comics now. Kirby was out of comics. Neil Adams wasn't doing anything actively. Will Eisner was doing, you know, graphic novel work, but still it wasn't coming out regularly. So most of the stuff on the newsstands in around 89 or so wasn't that interesting to me anyway.
Yeah.
After having seen Watchmen and Dark Knight, I mean, that was a tough act to follow. Plus, we were starting our business. And like I said, you know, trying to buy our first house, that kind of thing. I just got married and it was just kind of seemed like comics didn't have a place in my life at that point, just because of life changes. So,
yeah.
But I do remember though, how stunned I was after Kirby died and going in my first time into a comic book shop in like 5 years, which would have been like 1994, probably in April or May,
yeah.
walking into my city comic shop here, having not seen new comics for several years and looking at, I saw the word Image on a logo on the corner of one of the books. I'm like, Image, that must be a new company. What is this?
Yeah.
And I pulled it out and I was just like, whoa, this is what comics are now. I really, really felt like a dinosaur, completely out of touch because, it just was definitely not the comics that I was reading when I had stopped in 88. So,
sure.
But
what about that? Like made you realize that it was different. I mean, there's obvious aesthetic qualities, but like, what was it that shocked you about it that was so different?
I think the art styles were just so, I was used to a much simpler, cleaner version of storytelling
sure.
from artists like Kirby and Eisner and Adams and Wally Wood, those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And then to see what the Image guys were doing, they were so amazingly detailed with the amount of line work they would put into things. And the coloring was so, I felt over-rendered with the airbrush coloring. It's to me, the coloring detracted from the art.
Uh-huh.
It was overpowering the art. But one thing that really shocked me was, I think it was an issue of Eclipso that DC put out.
Yeah.
And there was on the cover, they had glued a little gem, like a little plastic fake jewel. Eclipso was holding. I remember this.
Remember this now. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
And I was just flabbergasted. It's like, you're kidding me. People are paying money for these special effects. And I saw, you know, foil stamping and holograms and
yeah.
things like that on all the different covers. And those were the kind of things, as far as our advertising career goes, we fought hard to convince a client to spring for the extra money to do something like embossing or foil stamping or any kind of special techniques when we would design annual reports and brochures and things for them.
Yeah.
And to see that, you know, run-of-the-mill comics on the stands were having these special effects on them, I was amazed. I was amazed at the quality of the paper they were printing on.
Yeah.
But then I was also amazed at the cover price of comics then too. I was like, wow, how does a little kid, you know, it was what?
Yeah.
Back then it was probably $2.99, I think, for comics. And when I left off, it was still, I think it was, you know, I think it was 75 cents was the highest cover price when I quit buying comics, I think.
Oh,
except
wow.
Except for occasional things. So, all of that kind of combined together too. I was like, wow, I really did feel like a dinosaur. So that's another reason I didn't think this Jack Kirby newsletter I was going to do would I had no visions of it being this big, expansive thing. I figured I'd do, you know, 5 or 6 issues, print a couple hundred copies, and that'd be done with. And but turned out, no, there were a lot more fans out there waiting around for something like this. Yeah. They didn't even know they were waiting for it until it showed up, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's a major sort of shift in, and like I said earlier, like life change. I mean, and when that happens, I'm assuming that tomorrow's kind of like overtakes everything else, like takes over your life, correct? Once it starts moving?
Well, initially, like I said, it was only 16 pages.
Yeah.
And we hand Xerox, so it was 16 pages coming out every 2 months, and that was it. That was our entire output in terms of publishing. So it wasn't like some super time-consuming thing. I mean, you know, I'd work a couple weekends a month on it or something like that, and, you know, and then answer the letters as they came in. But quickly, once we started, my favorite Kirby work of all time was his New Gods Fourth World material for DC Comics in the early 70s. Uh-huh. And I knew before this Jack Kirby newsletter ends, I wanted to do one issue just about that material. Mm-hmm. And that was our 6th issue. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to double the page count just this one time because I really want to do this right. And I interviewed everybody I could find that was involved with it and did a whole lot of research to get that issue done and was really proud of the result. And I was like, okay, with twice as many pages, we're going to have to actually pay to print this instead of photocopying it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we used up a little money we had in savings for that and just took a shot on it. And oh my gosh, the response was amazing. It was just incredible. And that led us to go into comic book stores and that expanded even more. And that's where it really started growing once we started going through Diamond Comic Distributors to all the comic shops, which back in that day, that was the Image Day too. And there were 5,000 comic book stores in this country at this point. As opposed to now, it's probably more like 1,500 left, I think.
Jeez, really? That so, little? Holy
yeah,
cow.
Yeah, I think that's about right. And it had no idea it would explode like it did.
But it's so amazing to me because something going from like a hobby that you're like, oh, I'm going to do a little pamphlet, and then it becomes like your business like 25 years later, at some point, you know, there must have been a thing where you went to your wife, me being married, and being like, I want to do this full time, or like we can do this full time. And obviously that's sort of a risky, you know, venture and stuff like that. Like what is the sort of like sea change that occurs in your brain? Because like you had said, you were like, oh, I was like out of comics and this is comics are different, but you obviously saw a market for the people that still loved like the older stuff or were interested in the history and going deeper than what Image was doing or what, you know, other companies were doing at that time. Can you sort of speak to that? Because like, to me, it's like from going from like, I'm not reading comics at all anymore to just like delving into it to the point where you are, you know, I mean, you're an expert. I mean, according to your stuff said, you were like deposed in the Kirby lawsuit and all this, you know, amazing stuff. Like am I making any sense? Does that make any sense? Like what I'm asking?
Yeah.
Because I'm fascinated by it.
Well, it really evolved. It wasn't like one day we decided, you know what? Yeah. We're just going to stop doing advertising, graphic design, and just do publishing. It really did evolve. And for the first probably 10 years, it still stayed as much as we could being a hobby. It was really our side work, but our advertising, graphic design was far and away our main work. You know, advertising just pays a whole lot better. It's not as fun and rewarding certainly as doing the publishing, but it certainly does pay a whole lot better. And but around 2005 or 2006, it wasn't me going to my wife Pam. It was Pam coming to me and saying, you know, as she's always been a very excellent advisor for me in all different ways in life. She says, you know, we're not getting any younger, and people like, they like 20 and 30 year old graphic designers that are viewed as being, you know, cutting edge. They don't really like 50 year old graphic designers so much.
Oh no.
So we might want to think about our future here. And at that point I was like, well, okay, you know, that's not a bad idea. And we made a conscious effort. Well, I guess it was probably around 2003 or 2004. We made a conscious effort to start improving or increasing our publishing output. Sure. We didn't intentionally cut our advertising back. We just started working harder and more frequent on the publishing. Yeah. But which was a good thing, because when the recession hit in 2007, most of our advertising work just dried up. Everybody budgets were cut. They took stuff in-house. We were scrambling for advertising work. And I think if we hadn't have increased our publishing output in 2004, 2005, I don't know what I'd be doing today. Yeah. I have no idea. So, but yeah, it was really more of a progression kind of thing. It wasn't just a one day, hey, I'm going to quit what I'm doing and do this instead. It sure. moved along.
Sure. Sure. But I mean, you must surprise yourself when you look around and you're like, I gave up comics and now I'm like knee deep in it. Right.
Well, I do. We're working on a book right now celebrating our 25th anniversary, and that's going to be coming out in the fall. Oh, and going back through, and we're interviewing all the contributors that worked along the line, and I'm refreshing my memory on things I'd completely forgotten about the progression of our company, little details. For instance, Roy Thomas, I assumed that John Cook was the one that got Roy Thomas to come in and restart Alter Ego magazine, because it was a fanzine in the 60s that he did before he got employed up at Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And he restarted it with Tomorrow's in 1999, I guess, or 98. Uh-huh. And my fuzzy memory was like, oh, yeah, John Cook convinced him to come in. But Roy's like, no, you did. And I've got the facts right here from you saying, hey, have you ever thought about restarting this? I'm like, well, okay, well, great. I guess I get credit for that one. But yeah, after 25 years, it's like, yeah, I do. I look back at this stuff and it's just like, wow, see how far we've come. But it's still fun to do. You know, I did this book, for instance, Stuff Said, it was such a ridiculous amount of work to do.
Yeah.
I worked harder on this book than any other thing we've ever published. But at the same time, you know, it was a lot of fun to do. And I look back on it with a lot of pride. And, you know, I'm sure 25 years from now, I'll look back on it and remember the experience and see it favorably. I mean, it's been just a really great, fun ride with a couple little minor exceptions, little hiccups along the way. It's all gone well. So.
Sure. Well, let me ask you a little bit more just about Jack Kirby, because I will be honest, like as a kid, when I was a kid, I started collecting like in the 80s. So for me, it was the first comic I ever collected. And I believe he has a column in your Retro Fan magazine, and I'm friends with him, Scott Shaw. The first comic I ever collected was Captain Carrot and His Amazing Zoo Crew. And I had lived in South America for a year and we just moved back to the US. And I saw it on the stands and I was like, I think I just wanted anything that was like American or pop culture or anything. Like I was like 10 or something, 11, 12. And I saw that and I was just blown away by that. So for me, something like Scott Shaw. And then from then on, I was like John Byrne. Those were like sort of like my introductions to like my comic book sort of fandom, you know, a little bit of Frank Miller here and there. Although I think he was a little bit too mature for my mind to understand like the stories at the time. But what is it? And whenever I would see some of the older stuff, and I remember Jack Kirby, there was something about Jack Kirby's art that as a teenager or a young kid, I did not gel with. Like Walt Simonson was a big one that I loved. Mm. There was something about Jack Kirby. I don't know what it was. It was like the blockiness of it or whatever. And it wasn't until I moved to LA, like in my, like after 19 in my early 20s, I saw his work in a museum and there was something. It just like hit me like a thunderbolt. Like I was standing there and just like, oh, like I get it. Like, you know what I mean? Like I had that moment and I don't know if it's just that I had been exposed to like, you know, I think by that time they were doing like superpowers books or something with him in them.
Right.
And not been exposed to enough of like the early stuff or whatever. But standing in front of an original like Jack Kirby, it's one of the most memorable experiences of my life because it literally took my breath away. And I was like, I get it. Like, you know what I mean? So what was it about? Do you remember what your first Jack Kirby book was?
Absolutely. And it's funny because what you just described mimics my experience almost to a T.
Oh, really?
It was because I grew up in the, I was born in 1962. So I missed the whole Marvel, Stanley Jack Kirby era as it was happening.
Yeah.
But it was around 1974, I made a big trade with my good buddy, Matt. I traded him a whole bunch of my comics I didn't want anymore for a bunch of his that he didn't want anymore.
Yeah.
And it was a good deal, but I was thumbing through and then at the end there were a couple of comics. I'm like, I don't want these. This isn't interesting to me. And one of them was Commandy number 12.
Oh, wow.
And it has a picture of Commandy, basically hanging on for dear life to this big giant grasshopper that he's trying to ride. Jumping straight at you. And I was like, I don't want this. I like superheroes. This isn't superhero. I don't want this. And he says, well, that's the deal. You got to take the whole stack because I don't want them. I'm like, okay, fine. So after I finished going through that whole stack, reading all the ones that I got in that trade deal, the last one left was Commandy. And I'm like, well, I got nothing else to read. Let me just read this. And I had heard of Jack Kirby before, and I'd even seen a little of his work here or there, but I hated it. I was just like you. It's like, hey, he's blocky. He's got big square knees and big square fingertips. And all of his women that he draws all are these big voluptuous, you know, it just didn't appeal to me.
Yeah.
But I sat down and started reading that Commandy issue. And by the last page, I was a Jack Kirby fan. And there was just something about it. It just clicked in my brain after reading. And I totally went in hating that book. I had no interest in reading, but I was just so bored. I had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And I remember at the end of that thinking like, man, if this thing is that good, what is this superhero stuff like? And that just launched me on it. But you know what you were talking about in the 80s, if you saw Jack Kirby's superpower stuff, that is far and away not his best work.
And the reproductions aren't good either.
The printing then was really horrible.
But
there's little germs of brilliance that come through in some of that material. But I think you have to be I think you have to be attuned to it to really pick out what's going on in that later work.
Yeah.
As for Kirby fans, we look at the Superpowers books and his Captain Victory stuff, and we know it's not his best work, but there's stuff in there that's just brilliant. But if you're not in tune with Kirby, those wouldn't be great ones to start with. Yeah. Something like, you know, 60s Fantastic Four or 70s, you know, New Gods or The Demon, OMAC even, that kind of stuff, that'd be a great place to start. Anybody new for Kirby. Because I think one issue into that and you'll be hooked. It's just stuff.
It's interesting because here at Cal State Northridge, in the area where I live, they had a gallery of like Jack Kirby's work. Yeah, a couple of years ago. Did you come out and see
I did. I made the trip out because I couldn't miss that great of an exhibition.
That's amazing.
Professor Charles Hatfield assembled that. Oh my gosh, he did such a fantastic job on that. It was worth the trip out. Absolutely. I'm so glad I was able to get out there and see it.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like the Commandy stuff, particularly, I had not really been exposed to much of that stuff. And because they were kind of hard to find, you know, and not necessarily, I don't think they had been reprinted that much, you know, before I had seen them or I just wasn't aware of it, my ignorance or whatever. But that, it's so funny to me because, and it is true of a lot of comic art, when you see it in person, it just doesn't. Like, I mean, obviously the comic stuff is, you see it in the comic and it looks great and it looks good. But like when you see it in person, like in stark black and white with the original, you know, ink, you know, lines and all that stuff, it really is astounding. Like I was like, this guy was amazing. Like looking like the imagination just on the page. I was just like, it's crazy.
Well, right. And seeing the art full size as opposed to reduced down in the comics too.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Mike Royer was his prominent inker at DC Comics in the 70s. And Mike, so meticulous at following Jack's work. He was so faithful to the pencil drawings that it's like Kirby's actual pencil drawings, but they pop even more because they're in black ink.
Yeah.
And I'm no huge original art collector, but I've got a couple of Jack Kirby original art pages and
that's amazing.
Inked by Mike Rory, and they're just gorgeous. And Mike actually, we can get into this later, but we've got a publication coming out later this year. It's called Jack Kirby's Dingbat Love, that's going to be reprinting. Jack Kirby did a series called The Dingbats of Danger Street in the 70s at DC. Only the first issue was published. There are two unpublished issues of that. And then he also did two books, one called Soul Love and one called True Divorce Cases. Those remain unpublished too. We worked out a deal with DC Comics. We're going to compile all those unpublished stories into one big hardcover volume.
Yeah.
And I've gotten Mike Royer to go in and re-ink one of the, or to ink one of the stories that's in there that's only in pencil, never been inked before. So that'll be a nice little bonus for the book as well. And Mike has not lost his touch one bit. He's still just as amazing as ever.
That's great. Wow, that's amazing. So you're still putting new, quote unquote, new Kirby stuff out there.
Yes, I think this is about it, though, as far as unpublished Kirby work.
Yeah.
Unless his original presentation pages for Spider-Man that he brought to Stan Lee surface someday. Nobody's seen those.
Oh, really?
But other than that, I'm not aware of anything else unpublished out there after this book we're going to do that still exists. But then again, you know, I figured after 5 or 6 issues, we'd exhaust all the unpublished Kirby sketches and interviews and things like that. And we're still finding things he did for people. So who knows what might turn up in the future.
Sure, absolutely. So let me ask you about Stuff Said. It's Kirby and Lee, Stuff Said, is the title of the book. And I heard about this, actually, I think Scott Shaw might have posted about it on Facebook. And another friend of mine, Miguel Sima, he runs a site called Dig Comics. And they were talking about it on Facebook. And this was shortly after Stan Lee passed away, or at least that I became aware of it, that it was coming out. I wanted to read about this book. I mean, I wanted to read this book. And then much like everything else, you know, being a parent and running a podcast and trying to do like a little dinky mini comic on my own, you know, I lost track of it. And then I got your email and I was like, wait a minute, that's out? Like, you know, and the clouds cleared in my brain. And I was like, I've got to talk. If they will do an interview with me, I really just want to talk about this book, because at the time of Stan Lee's passing, you know, there was a lot of debate going on social media. Like, people were like, you know, unfortunately, Stan Lee was being credited in a lot of publications still as being the sole creator of the Marvel Universe, which of course, like, set a lot of fans off. And, you know, people were like, no, he's, you know, I mean, to going to the extremes, like, no, Stan Lee was a charlatan. No, Stan Lee was a ripoff artist, blah, 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 which obviously that's an extreme, you know, opinion or whatever that sort of people have. But yeah, I became aware of this book and I was like, I have to read this book, because from what I understand, you're offering and what I've read so far in the book, because I just got it Friday, you're offering a very balanced view of the sort of the debate that's been raging on for like 40 plus years, right?
Well, that's the goal anyway. Yeah. Depending on what someone's individual prejudices are, though, there's a fringe element on both sides, on the Stan Lee side and on the Jack Kirby side, that sure, have taken this book and gone like, oh, wow, you were way too easy on Stan Lee in this book. You give him too much credit. And on the flip side, they're like the exact opposite on the Stan Lee side. Oh, you were too harsh on Stan in this book, you know, and you're giving Kirby too much credit. And so I guess I'm hitting a pretty good balance here, because that's a very small amount of people on either side that have issued any complaints about it. And the vast overwhelming majority of people are just stunned by this book. And I'm so humbled by the reaction that it's gotten so far. People seem to get it. They get what the idea was. We're not out to make somebody a villain or make somebody a hero. We're out to just present the facts as plainly as possible and let people reach their own decision. In the book, the genesis of this book is but of course this debate has been raging on for years and years.
Sure.
You know, Stan Lee gets most of the public credit, but the more informed comics fans in the comics community know how much Kirby contributed.
Sure.
You know, but the general public, they see Stan Lee making cameos in all the Marvel films and things like that and think, oh, Stan Lee, he's Mr. Marvel. He created everything.
Yeah.
And for years and years, it really behooved Marvel to promote that view, dating all the way back to the 60s, which we get into that in the book, why they would have promoted Stan and Stan only. There are a lot of copyright issues involved, and certainly, you know, you don't want to give any of your freelance artists credit for creating things, because then that opens up rights issues. So whereas if you give your paid company employee like Stan Lee all the credit, then you don't have those problems, because he works for the company directly and there's no legal issues there. So that's why it behooved Marvel in the 60s particularly to promote Stan so well. But also, Stan was a natural promoter, a natural advertising guy. You know,
he
knew how to market a product. Yeah, absolutely. He's a great salesman and did a great job. And he's largely responsible for the commercial success of Marvel. He was out there, as you'll see in the book, the number of Stan Lee interviews in this book that we quoted from versus the number of Jack Kirby, it's probably 20-1, I would think, if you had to calculate it. But yeah, the book is, it's basically a book that came about through the lawsuit, which was it was Marvel Characters versus the Kirby family. It was right after Disney bought Marvel for $4 billion in 2009. At that point, the Kirby family had already planned to try to reclaim Kirby's copyrights on the thing before the Disney sale ever even came up, because after a certain number of years, a freelance creator is able to reclaim any rights they might have sold away or given away or whatever.
Oh, interesting.
And,
yeah.
And that was the time period. It was 2009 was when they were going to reclaim his copyrights on it.
Yeah.
So it's all, you know, it's all simple little legal thing. But of course, Marvel was not crazy about that, particularly when Disney got involved. They were not crazy about giving up any rights on things. So
yeah.
So that started a very long, protracted legal battle, which I had a very, very tiny part in.
Yeah. But you were deposed, correct, according to your book, right? Yeah.
Yes, I was brought in as an expert witness in the case and spent
impressive. I'm going to say that's impressive. Anyway, go on.
Well, after documenting Kirby's career for 20 years, I think I think I had the credibility to be claimed an expert witness. But
sure.
Yeah, that was a very long day of being grilled by Disney's and Marvel's attorney.
Wow.
But it was it really enlightened me in terms of what was at stake in this, and the fact that the facts really matter, right? In any kind of court case, it's all about testimony and depositions and getting the facts straight. And so,
well, and my sister also likes to say language, the way that things are said and, you know, stated in contracts and stuff like that. Language has a big deal. Would you agree with that? Or
absolutely. I mean, that's part of the reason I chose to, you know, the book's called Stuff Said, which is a riff on Stanley's famous, you know, Nuff Said expression.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's all about things that were said by Kirby and Lee about their working relationship, and also Steve Ditko, who's co-creator of Spider-Man, things he said as well.
Yeah.
So I had planned this to come out in 2014 originally, but then they finally settled out of court on the court case. And at that point, I was like, okay, everybody's had enough of this. It's been a long, tiring fight for everybody, including me. And we'll just let this rest for a while. But it just kept kind of nagging at me. And so last year, I decided, okay, I'm going to bring this idea back off and really do it upright. And I basically researched, dug through every single interview I could find with Stan Lee and with Jack Kirby, read them all, viewed them all online, listened to all the radio interviews, pulled out any pertinent quotes about their creative working relationship together, and had to assemble them all into chronological order, which was quite a monumental task, I gotta say. So the number of hours of just Stan Lee interviews we listened to, and so many of them, he was such a great commercial salesman, but he had his patter down pat. And so many of the interviews were almost to the word repetitious about how he did this and how he did that and what happened. So you get a whole lot of repetition. So you have to kind of go through a lot of a long, long editing process to make something, boil down to more of the concrete information that people can absorb. So,
well, can I ask you about that repetition? Because I mean, that's sort of a thing that you notice, like say, like when a movie's coming out and a celebrity's being interviewed, and like you see them interviewed like on one talk show and then you'll see them interviewed on another, and it's like, oh, they're saying the same thing that they said on that other show. This must be sort of like a verbatim thing, a line of questioning that they already have set up, or ideas that they've already like set up for interviewing for this project. You know what I mean? And then there's like sort of a thing of like, I guess sometimes when a prosecutor or an investigator is like interviewing someone and they interview them about like say a murder or something like that. Obviously this isn't a murder, but like they try to notice like differences in, you know, the story as it goes on. So, I mean, does that repetitiveness of Stan Lee in your mind sort of belie like one, like having like his whole story like set up, or is there, does it help him in the truthfulness of what he's saying? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I've been asked that from people who haven't read the book yet, but they want to know more about it.
Like, sure.
How consistent was Stan in his story over the years? And how consistent was Jack Kirby in his stories over the years about what went on in their creatorship? The nice thing about doing this in chronological order is that you can kind of weight the earlier comments that were done actually in the 60s while the work was being produced. You can wait, give those a little more weight than the ones, say, done in the 80s or the 90s after both guys were away from the material and it was more of a PR type interview situation. So,
sure.
I'll say generally both of them, even though they disagreed with each other, they were both pretty consistent in their own stories over the years.
Uh-huh.
What What did strike me, and not trying to bash Stan Lee here, but no. Later in his later interviews, all of a sudden, some of these facts that in his 60s interviews he wasn't sure about, he was 100% certain about in the 80s.
Gotcha.
So we've got a couple of instances where he would say in interviews in the 60s where, yeah, I don't remember if Jack came up with the name Galactus and Silver Surfer or if I did.
Yeah.
He said that a couple times in interviews in the 60s. So he's pretty unsure in the 60s. It wasn't just a one-time accidentally said that. I mean, he said it in a couple of interviews in the 60s. In the 80s interviews and 90s interviews, he's absolutely certain he came up with the name Galactus, the name Silver Surfer. You know, those are that may seem like a small thing in the scheme of things, and it is. It's not that critical. You know, people's memories change. You get older, you know, you get more hardened in your views and things.
Yeah.
But there's also, you got to kind of weigh in there the factor that once big budget movies and merchandising and all that stuff starts coming into play,
yeah.
There's a whole lot at risk, and you want to shore up your stake in things.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying just Stan. I think Jack may have been victim to that as well in some of his later interviews. So it is nice to be able to see this all in chronological order, and you can go, oh, well, he said he wasn't sure about the names in the 60s, so I'm going to give that a little more credence than him saying he was sure he came up with them in the 80s.
Yeah.
And there are small instances like there. There's not like one huge smoking gun in this book. I will warn people if that's what they're looking for, that so-and-so is lying. He's the worst person on earth, you know, or this proves that other guy was lying. But there are a lot of shades of gray in this book. And I think it's really kind of up to the reader to read it, make their own evaluation, seeing how views changed and didn't change as time went on.
Sure.
And even though I set it up sort of like a court case with testimony in the book, and I give my verdict at the end, my verdict is irrelevant, really. You don't even have to read my decision at the end. Anyone that reads this book cover to cover can make their own decision on what they think is true and accurate and what's not.
Sure.
So that's what's kind of fun about it. And that's really why I did the book. There were inconsistencies in what I perceived as what one man said versus the other, and what they had said later versus what they said earlier, that always nagged at me. And I really wanted to go back and go, okay, what have they said all along?
Yeah.
And really see, did it change, or were they saying the same thing in the 60s that they said in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah.
I think readers will find some fascinating discoveries by reading this through chronologically like that.
Well, the one thing that stuck out to me, and I've just started reading the book, and I think it's amazing. Like, I'm just looking through it, I'm like, I cannot wait to finish this thing. Like, I'm just like chomping at the bit, like to just like plow into it. I've been selling Girl Scout cookies over the weekend. Everyone support your local Girl Scout troop. But
I just bought some.
Yeah, good for you. Good for you. It helps the Girl Scouts. But the one thing that I read like towards the beginning, and I love the way that you lay everything out. I love the way that you're like, here are the players. I love how you're like, you're very determined to be like, this is the timeline. This is when this happened. This is sort of like the context of it. Like that is very smartly put together and very, reverent to both sides, I think. And just being like, okay, this is what was happening. But the one thing that I found really fascinating, particularly in the opening, is the distinction of writing, of like what is writing a comic book? And, you know, I just like, you hear so many different stories, because the thing that we, people of my generation, were first exposed to, like, how is a comic book written, is how to write comics the Marvel way, right? And it's sort of like the Marvel method. You write a paragraph and, you know, they show, I think, I don't even know if in that book they show like a full script where it's like, this happens in this panel, here's the dialogue, or I can't remember correctly. I'd have to pull out my copy. But it's interesting to me how you're like, people say like I wrote, and in maybe Stan Lee's mind, it was like writing means I did all the dialogue, and that sort of like changed the pacing of the story or the feel of the story. And then like in Jack Kirby's mind, it was like, well, I wrote because I was just given an outline of what I should do. And then I drew everything. And in the panels, like I had notes, and then Stan picked up on that. And then, you know, there was like other instances where, yeah, maybe Stan and Jack did write like the full story together. I just found that fascinating. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I was like, I don't know. I mean, I knew that this like it existed, but in my mind, it was like sitting there reading your book, I was like, mind blown. Like, you know?
Well, that's a key thing to this whole discussion of who did what in creating the Marvel books. Stan had final say because he was editor, and he could write the credit boxes.
Yeah.
And in the credits, it would usually say written by Stan Lee, drawn by Jack Kirby. And that's such a simplified version of how these books were created. It's not accurate. If for people listening that don't understand the Marvel method, the Marvel method evolved in the early 60s when Lee and Kirby got together. It was more of a way to save Stan Lee some work and make it so he could produce more books in a shorter amount of time. What he did, he brought artists in, and he would sit down with the artists, and they would have a real quick little creative plot conference. They'd kick around ideas and say, okay, for this issue of Fantastic Four, what are we going to do? So like Lee and Kirby would kick ideas back and forth and come up with a very quick loose idea of what to do. And at that point, Jack Kirby would go back to his home where he worked and sit there and turn that quick little maybe one paragraph idea, if it was even written — it usually wasn't even written, sometimes it was just spoken back and forth, just a brainstorming session — he'd go home and turn that little quick session into a full, 20-22 page story that he would pencil out, figure out the pacing on. He'd introduce some new little characters and things here and throughout the story that they maybe probably hadn't even talked about, just what he thought would make an interesting story. Because, I mean, at that point, Jack had already had 20-year career in comics before the first issue of Fantastic Four, producing some of the best-selling comics ever with his former partner, Joe Simon. And so he was a seasoned professional at that point. And, he didn't need a lot of hand-holding by any means. A quick little conference, hey, let's come up with a character. Okay, well, a villain, what are we going to call him? How about the name Dr. Doom? Sounds good. What's his deal? Oh, he wears armor. Okay, great. He'd go home and come up with a story.
Yeah.
He'd bring back these pages all fully penciled, turn them into Stan. Stan would then, at that point, write the words that go in all the balloons and the caption boxes. He might, Jack would put these little notes in the margins to tell Stan what he was thinking was going on here. And Stan would follow those sometimes. Sometimes he'd deviate from those little notes that Jack left and maybe slightly change things to more the kind of story he wanted to tell.
Sure.
But still using Jack's drawing. So it really, what you got was an interesting mix of two people's input. But to say that one wrote it and one drew it, that's not accurate. But that's what the credit said, and that's where a lot of this dispute came from.
Yeah.
So now, to get back to what you're saying about the book itself, that is such a big part of the dispute, because Kirby felt he wrote it because he took that little tiny plot conference they had and turned it into a full-fledged book with his notes in the margin saying what was going on, right?
Yeah.
So he felt, in that way, that he wrote the book. He didn't write the words in the balloons because Stan didn't let him do that. And he didn't write the little notes in the captions, but he felt like he wrote these stories and that anybody at that point could then go in and fill in word balloons. Stan, however, felt like he was writing it, and he was sometimes changing the direction that Kirby had set on his pencil pages and making it his. So that made him the writer. So that led to the big creative differences, which really came to a head around the end of 1965 between the two of them. For the rest of the 1960s, working together, it was a very strained relationship for Kirby. And till finally 1970, Kirby was done and moved over to DC Comics. But in the book, anywhere in an interview where we're quoting somebody, because the credits could say written by, scripted by, different words that all meant writing.
Yeah.
And anywhere in a quote where someone is quoted saying, I wrote, I scripted, I whatever, I highlight those out in the text.
Yeah.
So as you're reading through, if you hit one of those highlighted words, written or wrote, script, something like that, the idea is that you should stop for a second and think, what do they really mean here? Do they really mean I physically wrote it from scratch? Or does it mean I just filled in some word balloons? And that's the trick. There are no full scripts in this book because no full scripts exist. That's not how Marvel worked. DC in the 60s did. A writer would sit down, be the first person involved, write a script, and give a fully complete composed script to the artist, and they would work from that. And then in that instance, at DC, the credits were correct. Written by, Robert Koeniger, right? Drawn by Joe Kubert. That's accurate at DC Comics. At Marvel, it was not that way. It was such a mix of both people's talents that you're selling both people short by using simple credits like that. So there's very few actual written plot ideas or synopses in this book as well, because very few of those even exist. It was mostly all done just verbally over lunch or with a quick meeting in the office, something like that, kicking ideas back and forth. They'd ride, sometimes Stan would give Jack a ride home in the back of his convertible, and they'd be, you know, kicking ideas around while they're driving through the traffic in New York City. So, you know, that's just how it worked. It was all very loose and freewheeling. And that's where a lot of the, unfortunately, a lot of the differences came in. But yeah, pointing those out in the book, where when is writing really not mean writing? That was a key component of getting this across, making sure people understand what the dispute was.
Yeah, it's a brilliant distinction. And I think it's like only like two or three paragraphs in the beginning of the book. But I was like, wow, yeah, that means a lot. Like it's great that you did that, because it definitely, for somebody like me who obviously has heard a lot of different stories, maybe not all of them, it really opened my eyes to be like, oh yeah, well, that's why this is such a mess. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it was just really fascinating. Not to ruin sort of like your verdict or spoil the end of the book or anything, because I haven't even gotten to it or anything. But what is your feeling? And maybe because it's mostly fresh in my mind, because Stan Lee passed away recently. You know, because there are people who want to paint Stan Lee as like this villain in the whole piece. Like, he was a company man. He didn't back up his friends. And I have had that viewpoint myself, you know, at times. And, you know, apparently I don't know the full details of everything, but there's a dispute with Jack Kirby not being able to get his original art back and stuff like that. Can you speak a little bit to that sort of thing?
Sure, sure. Well, I think it's much too simplified to say that Stan Lee was a bad man who cheated Jack Kirby, and poor Jack Kirby never got what he was due. Sure. That's a much too simplified situation or explanation of the situation. I finished this book, I think it was about, I sent it to the printer about 10 days before Stan passed away back in December. And to the point where as soon as he passed away, I was like, oh shoot, I've got to change like the last page and just put some mention that Stan passed away. But it was too late. They were already printed and being bound, and we couldn't reprint the whole thing just to sneak that in. So, but it's kind of irrelevant. I would have not had a different view had Stan already been deceased when I finished the book versus that he was still alive when I finished the book.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give away too much of my verdict in the book in case some people are actually waiting to see that. But in my verdict, I pull out two very short quotes that I think in a large part sum up the differences between these two guys.
Yeah.
In one, it's Stan Lee. And one thing I did in this book, anywhere Stan Lee is quoted, I print it in red type. And anywhere Jack Kirby is quoted, I print it in blue type. And that was intentional. So it's much easier for you to see who's talking when without a bunch of Stan Lee said blah, 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 and Jack Kirby said blah, 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 which just kind of, you know, slows down the flow of the book. Yeah. But the important quote from Stan to me is that he says the dialogue I have always felt is the most important thing, just like it is in a radio or TV show. Whereas Kirby's quote that I pulled out that I think is the most key one, he says, the penciler is the one who tells the story, who visualizes it. It's not a writer's medium or an inker's medium. The decisive factor is the artist. Oh. And I think that's the core of this. And you'll get more in depth, because there's much more to my verdict than that, particularly dealing with the owner of Marvel Comics, Martin Goodman, and the sneaky things he did to Jack Kirby over the years. But I think that's the key to the conflict between Kirby and Lee. Lee viewed what he was doing as the most important thing. Kirby viewed what he was doing as the most important thing.
Yeah.
And I think they both viewed that anyone else could do the other guy's part, but only I could do my part.
Gotcha.
And that's where the conflict came. That and the fact that, well, Stan was in charge and Jack was kind of under his thumb in terms of how he got credited for things. And Stan would get all the public recognition, and while Jack was at home slaving away, there's a great thing. Stan's out giving an interview, in 1967 or 68, I'd have to look, giving an interview about, I just don't know what we're going to do about the FF's, baby. They're about to have a baby. Sue Storm's about to have a baby. And I just don't know whether it's going to be a boy or a girl, if it's going to have superpowers, if it's going to be, you know, a mutant, whatever. Stan's giving this interview. And at the very time Stan is giving that interview, Jack Kirby is at home drawing Fantastic Four Annual number 6, where she gives birth and deciding what happens. Wow. So I think, and that's the fascinating thing about chronologically, we're not just listing their quotes chronologically, we're juxtaposing them against what work was being produced at the time these quotes were being given.
Yeah.
And that gives a whole lot more insight into the working relationship. And I think that's, you know, people are really fascinated by that. It's like, oh, wow, Stan was saying this at the time he was writing the dialogue for this story. And, oh, Jack was drawing this when he said that. It just really adds a whole another fascinating angle to their relationship.
Yeah, that's a great part of the book, too, is like you go through a timeline in the very beginning where you're like 1960, whatever, this Jack Kirby was probably drawing this like 3 months out, or this was 4 months out, or depending on whichever title or how many books he was working on, like how far out, you know, from this particular had Jack Kirby either already worked on or been working on the book. Like that's another really great touch too. I mean, it's all around like a really great package. I mean, I cannot wait to finish reading this thing. I did just get it, so I'm in the very beginnings of it, but I'm already impressed with just the opening of the book. And I just find it to be a fascinating like read, because I find all the stuff that I've gotten from Tomorrow's to be like really great reads, like the American Comic Book Chronicles, like that. That's like, come on, who's going to do an encyclopedia about like that stuff was great. Like, I don't think I have all of them, but I got most of them and I may have missed, you know, but I, you know, opening up the first one when I got it in the mail, I was just like, get out. Like, this is amazing. So like I said earlier, you're doing God's work in my opinion. And you can quote me on that. Tomorrow's doing God's work when it comes to comic book, the comic book industry. But the last question that I kind of wanted to ask you, and I've had you on for almost an hour and I really appreciate your time. Like, I've been wanting to interview somebody from your company, I guess, namely you, because you're in charge. Like, what is your response to somebody who would say, look, you wrote a book trying to balance out the story between Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, but how partial can you be being a person who's been publishing, like, you know, articles, books, you know, publications about Jack Kirby for like 25 years? Like, how do you see yourself as being able to be partial between the two? Like, is that a make sense question? Does that question make sense?
That's a very fair question. And someday when someone else starts the Stan Lee Collector Magazine and wants to do their own version of this book, they'll probably get that same question. Well, okay, I've been documenting Kirby's life and career for 25 years. I've been a Kirby fan since I was 14 years old and discovered that issue of Commandy. I there's an argument to be made that there's no way I could do a fair and balanced book. But the vast majority of people that have read this that don't come into it with a hardcore prejudice one way or the other have responded that this is, how much more balance could you get than this?
Sure.
On the one hand, because I did all of Stan's quotes in red and Jack's in blue, you can thumb through this book and see how much more red ink there is in here than blue. And that, you know, Stan got a lot more saying things because he was publicly interviewed way more than Jack Kirby was. So there's some balance towards Stan there, you could say, of Stan getting to tell his side of the story more than Jack did. At the same time, I didn't grow up, I think I said that earlier, I didn't grow up buying the, you know, the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby books off the newsstands. I worked backwards from there. I discovered Kirby by DC stuff and then kind of went backwards and discovered the Kirby Lee books. So I don't have that, you know, nostalgic appreciation for those books that I would if I had grown up buying those off the stands. So I think I'm able to look at those books a little more objectively. And as much as I enjoy them, they're not my favorite work by Stan or Kirby. I mean, you know, I probably am, it's inevitable I'm going to have some slant toward Kirby in this book that I wouldn't have toward Lee, just because of my love of Kirby's work and so many years being devoted to him. But at the same time, I really did bend over backwards to try to keep this as fair and unbiased as possible. All I can say is take a look and judge for yourself. I feel like I achieved the balance that I needed in this book. So, I think most readers so far seem to agree with me.
Yeah. And so, okay. So then one last question. I know I said one last question. I lied, but this will be the last question. What's your gold standard Kirby work? Like, what is the work that you think is like his gold standard? I mean, I know earlier you had said something about Fantastic Four, but what do you think?
Well, for me personally, for me personally, it's the Fourth World stuff that he did, the New Gods, Forever People, Miracle, and Jimmy Olsen. That just stands the test of time for me. I can go back and reread that and get something out of it. Kind of in the same way I can go back and reread Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen every few years and get something out of there that I didn't see the first time. Beast Fourth World material is that same way for me. DC just did a huge omnibus of it that they unfortunately, they missed one page and printed another page twice or something. So they had to go back and destroy copies and reprint it or something. But it's still that could come out today and people for the first time today and people would be blown away by it. It's timeless material. And I think we're going to see some kind of New Gods related movie coming out. They've been saying you're going to, you know, DC's movie universe is kind of in upheaval right now. So
But, that's one word for it.
You know, they got a big hit off of Aquaman and their Wonder Woman movie was good. So maybe they're learning. Maybe this new Shazam movie will be great. I hope so. I am looking forward to
Shazam. I will say that. Like, I'm very surprised. So I'll leave you with one story that I had recently and I actually posted on Facebook. My daughter had a sleepover birthday party recently. They're about like 11, 12 years old. And of course, my office in my house is like comic. There's comic stuff everywhere. And so they had a sleepover. They got up the next morning and had breakfast. And some of them were getting ready for their parents to pick up. And, you know, there's a bathroom in the hall and the doors are closed. But the girls are loud. And I hear one girl saying to another girl, "Stan Lee created Marvel. Stan Lee is Marvel." And I was just like, what? Like, I was just hearing this conversation. It was like, you know, very like little kid urgent, like, don't you know? And I was like, okay, this cannot stand. So like once they were like out in the living room getting ready to be picked up, you know, all shenanigans, I go into the living room and I say, who was in the bathroom saying, you know, that's not creepy, but who was in the bathroom that was saying, you know, that Stan Lee created the Marvel Universe? And one of the little girls like raises her hands. And I was like, no, Stan Lee co-created it with the artist Jack Kirby. And he drew all those pictures. So you just need to know that Jack Kirby was and the looks on all the girls' faces, whether it was from, you know, this girl's dad just came out and decided to school us on comic books, or we just learned something about, I don't know what they were more shocked by, but like, I just had to do it. I had to do it. Like, I couldn't just let it, you know, let it lie. I was just like, I've got to drop some knowledge on these kids because there's no way I'm letting that slip. So I figured I would just leave you with that in any case. So maybe you a...
Great job. I've got my own two daughters and they hear the name Stanley and Jack Kirby more than any two girls should have to. But I hope this book will likewise drop some knowledge on some people and maybe help clarify just what their respective roles were in creating the Marvel characters.
Yeah, I actually feel like buying a couple of copies for people and just handing them out on the street and just being like, here, take it, read it. But thank you so much. I just really appreciate your time and thank you for writing the book. And thank you again for just like doing all this work, because I know I don't read like every Tomorrow's publication, but when I'm at a convention, I always stop by the booth or, you know, I'll pick stuff up. You know, sometimes I'll see stuff like on Amazon or like, you know, online. And I've bought a lot of your stuff. So I'm just so happy to have you on the podcast. Thank you for your time. And thank you for writing this book, because I can't wait to read it. And the Lou Scheimer book was great too. It was just great.
Thank you. It was my pleasure and my honor being on this. And when you talk to your friend, Scott Shaw, ask him to tell you Kirby stories, because he was great friends with the Kirbys. And
I know. He tells me stuff all the time.
Hysterical stories about interacting with them. So.
Oh yeah, he's great. I love Scott Shaw. So he's just great. And he's a person that's actually encouraged my daughter to draw a lot. So he's just a wonderful person and I'm happy to call him a friend, but that's not who we're talking to on this podcast. We were talking to John Morrows of Tomorrows Publishing. Your website is tomorrows.com, correct?
Correct. Spelled TWOMORROWS.
Yes. .com. And you can check out all their stuff right now. They're having a really good deal a bundle on Draw Magazine, which is to me like one of my favorite things that you've done in the past several years. So you should go check that out on there. I don't know if it's on, is it on the clearance or warehouse sale? I don't know. It's on one of those links, but check it out because that is a great magazine. That is God's work for sure. But thank you so much, John Morrow. I really appreciate your time. My name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. We have been talking about Stuff Said, which you should all go read, particularly if you've ever been interested in comics. And even if you're not, you'll learn something new. And, you know, you'll about all those movies that you've been watching and throwing billions of dollars at for the past couple of years. Thanks, as always, for listening. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.
Part-timefanboy.com.